back. I hope you had a nice break. And you survived it. So now it's a slippery slide into the wind of the turn. I owe you still a couple of things. I was going to catch up on everything over the break, but not quite everything I caught up on. All right, so I will try to send out later today SA7 entries and ask you to rank them. And then I'll also try to put together the ranking compilation for SA6. I put SA8 on the web. It turns out that for this one, what I want you to do is to watch a movie, or at least a chunk of a movie, called What the Bleep Do We Know? And maybe do some of the reading, some of the critical reading that I put on the web. This is an interesting movie. You should look at it and see what you think. Read some of the stuff, and then I hope we can have some provocative discussion and recitation and maybe in your essays a little bit. Any questions or comments about class stuff? So, we've been talking about quantum mechanics, and one of the things that really characterizes quantum mechanics is the fact that you can't calculate specifics, in a sense. What you can calculate are probabilities and probability distributions. And we've seen that that can lead to it can lead to phenomenal successes. And one example we've looked at is if you put an electron, which you now treat as a wave, in a spherically symmetric Coulomb potential, so that is, it's just a negative and you have a positive nucleus that is attracting it, and if you assume the nucleus is so heavy it won't move, and you then put it into Schrodinger's wave equation and solve it, what you find are that you have specific quantized energy and spatial states that are allowed. And when you go and you look at all the implications and these states and everything, you find something that really is very close to a perfect description of what we see with the hydrogen atom. It isn't exactly perfect. There are some small refinements that come into play, but not much, and it's pretty well understood now. So it's a huge success for quantum mechanics. I mean, even the Bohr model, which was pretty successful, was fairly revolutionary, but it missed somewhat. It gave basically the spectral structure, but it wasn't perfect. So this is a huge thing. When this was solved, and it could be solved exactly, and physicists saw how well it worked, I mean, quantum mechanics is just pretty well established at that point. So quantum mechanics is full of lots of successes like that. The fact that you are stuck with this probability description leads to some strange things, some strange conceptual issues. We've seen the fact that if we send a wave, a particle that's a wave-like properties through a thin opening, we know because it's a wave that it has to undergo diffraction, which basically means it spreads out beyond that opening. And if we send thousands and thousands of these, even if we do them one at a time, or as a beam, it doesn't matter, what we will find is we will get these things to distribute themselves along the detector in this sort of spread out fashion, which is exactly what you would expect from diffraction. And we can calculate that exactly. But for any individual single electron, you don't know any more than that. All you know is the probability distribution of where it may hit a detector. And it's the wall over here. So then you remember we ran into this conceptual problem that means the way that you handle it mathematically is you just sort of think of the electron as being described by this wave function psi, and psi, as it propagates in space and time, basically has to propagate over to this detector. And because psi squared is basically just a probability distribution, You have to have encoded within this wave function this entire distribution, which means there's a non-zero probability that the electron ends up over here, or over here, or over there, and you don't know where. And then, when the electron interacts, it doesn't interact as a wave, it interacts as a particle. And so one of the weird things about this whole wave-particle duality is we now realize that photons and electrons have both wave and particle characteristics, but we still can't really think of them as having both things at the same time. We think of it as a wave when we think of Schrodinger's equation and the propagation of the probability distribution, but the moment that this photon or the electron interacts with the detector, it does so at a specific point, as if it were a particle, and that's how we describe it. So we have this very strange situation where we have this wave-like sort of smeared out nature up until the moment it interacts, and then we have 100% probability of that it interacted in the detector at a very particular spot. So there is this strange transition from sort of this unresolved quantum probability state to where whatever happens, happens, and the probability description basically collapses instantaneously, which is very bothersome. And we talked about the Copenhagen interpretation, where you basically try not to let that bother you because you really don't observe the wave function, you just observe this square, this probability. And so, in a sense, why should I care if the wave function has to collapse instantaneously if it's not observable? So to some people, that feels like you're just sweeping trouble under the rug. So another way to look at it is that the wave function is not this isolated little thing, but the wave function is in fact all of reality, and this is just a piece of the wave function. And what happens is that when you have a quantum mechanical process, all of the possibilities happen, and they just propagate out into this overall wave function. But it just so happens that you can only really perceive one of these things. And that's called the many worlds theory, which is a multiverse sort of theory. Experimentally, you can't distinguish between these two different ways of thinking about things, almost by design. But conceptually, they're quite different. So quantum mechanics is a bit strange. If that's not bad enough, I want to talk about another aspect of the strangeness of quantum mechanics. It makes sense, if you think of a particle, to think that you can know where it is and its momentum. That is how fast it's going, when you think of it that way. But it's a little harder to think about if you're thinking about a wave. And in fact, even in classical waves, it turns out if you want to describe the position of a wave, it turns out that you can specify that more and more carefully, but when you do, it turns out to be a sum of different momentum components. It may sound a little strange, but it works mathematically. A different way of saying that is the more you localize a wave in space, the less you actually know about its full momentum composition of all the pieces that sort of you use mathematically to describe it. This is just basically a consequence of waves. And Heisenberg recognized this and recognized that it had big consequences for particles and things if we want to think of them as waves. So a way to think about it practically is when something is really big, as we've seen, the wavelength from de Broglie is really, really short. And effectively, you don't think of it as a wave. It doesn't matter. So you don't diffract when you go through a doorway. Okay? If you want, you could imagine having a car that's zipping past you, and you could take a laser beam and shoot the car with a couple of pulses, and you could look at the reflection of those pulses, and you could see, for example, if I had pulses that were timed perfectly and I was able to measure the distance between the reflections, if I had pulses going out, I can measure the distance the car moves in a certain amount of time, and I would know its velocity or its momentum. And it's sort of what a cop does if he's looking at his feet. At the same time, where the light gets bounced off the car also tells me where the car happens to be. Okay? And in practice, I mean, in principle, there's no limit as to how well I can do that. I can have a smaller and smaller reflector on the car and more precise instrumentation and send out my big laser beam and get a reflection at a very particular spot. I can do that a couple of times. I can measure the distance between those very carefully because I can photograph it and know the distance. I can have meter six scales along the way so I can see where the car was exactly. So in Newtonian physics, and for something very large, you can know, for example, where the car happens to be and how fast it's going or its momentum as in as much precision as you would like. You know that as well as possible, simultaneously. There's no constraint on that. If we go to something very small, that starts to be practically impossible. So an example is, suppose we want to play exactly the same game, but we want to bounce the light off an electron instead of a car. And now what you find, when you go to very small, if I bounce light off of an electron, it turns out the electron will compensate. The light will bounce off the electron, but in doing so, it gives so much energy to the electron will go off at some weird angle. So, in a strange sort of way, when you get down to the very small, you cannot possibly dream up a technique where you can measure both its position and its momentum simultaneously with high precision. If you want to get its position better and better, then the light, the photon you send has to have a shorter and shorter wavelength, because then you know where the photon is. If you hit the electron with a shorter wavelength photon, that photon has more energy and it kicks the electron even harder. And so you know less about where it is, and you've given it some energy. So you may know where it is actually very precisely, but now you've kicked it really hard, so now you don't know anything about its momentum. So it's a very bizarre world when you go to the very small. It is easy to think of this as just a consequence of quantum mechanics, but it's really just a consequence of thinking of things as waves. It is true in classical physics that I can describe a wave pulse in terms of a whole bunch of waves with different momenta that I add up to mathematical description. And it turns out the narrower I make the pulse, the more different momentum components come into play. So if I know the position of the wave, if I specify the position of the wave by narrowing it, it turns out that mathematically I know less and less about momentum components. The same is true if I know the momentum of a wave very well. It turns out that if I can only do that if it's a very, very broad wave, then I actually have no idea what it is. So there is a there's sort of this inverse complementarity with position and momentum in basic wave analysis as is. And when carried over into quantum mechanics, it now means that where you're used to thinking I have a particle that can, I know where it is and basically where it's going, how fast it's going, simultaneously to arbitrary precision, I simply cannot do that in quantum mechanics. So this is known as the uncertainty principle, or Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. And quite honestly, it means that in the Newtonian world, where I can tell you the position and momentum of all the particles in the universe and what forces they're undergoing, and put it in a big computer and calculate the future of the universe, I now really, really, really can't do that. Because if I know exactly where a particle is, I know nothing about its momentum. If I know what its momentum is, I know nothing about where it is. So the deterministic universe is completely thrown out of the window. So that's a pretty serious thing. Now, you might say, I don't know that I really... I mean, okay, that's bothersome. That's a bit bothersome if you want to control the universe or understand the universe. That's a bit fundamentally bothersome. But practically, you might think, well, why do I really care? And it turns out that the main implication, I believe, really in physics, in terms of how it manifests itself in lots of exciting other things, and certainly how it manifests itself in terms of all the stuff we're going to talk about for the rest of this class, there's a different form of the uncertainty principle that you can basically derive from the first one, if you will, but it's intuitively less obvious, and I'm not going to really try to justify it too much because it doesn't quite lend itself as much to this sort of idea. And what it says is that in the same way that you cannot know the position and momentum of a particle with arbitrary precision simultaneously, if you measure some process over a shorter and shorter length of time, so your uncertainty over the lifetime of this process becomes less and less because you happen to see that it's a very short-lived process, it turns out that as this time goes very, very short, your knowledge of what the energy is of that system becomes arbitrarily poor. So sort of the uncertainty principle is the uncertainty in your energy times the uncertainty in how long the process exists. If you multiply those two uncertainties together, they have to be greater than some quantity. So if one of them gets really small, the other one has to be big. So, what does that mean? One thing it means is you may have noticed that when we look at the spectral lines using gratings, they basically look like thin little lines. What does that mean? That means that when the electron in that atom jumped from one high energy level to a lower energy level, it emitted a particular frequency of light. So that if I spread the frequencies out, I would see that light all show up at one frequency. Okay? If, in fact, one of these energy levels in the atom lives only a short amount of time, then it's not basically fairly stable, but it lives a very short amount of time. When it decays, its energy is not well defined. And in fact, if we have a really powerful instrument, we would see that some of those spectral lines actually are wide in frequency. They actually, it's as if the light that comes off with a smear in energy because the energy isn't well determined because of the lifetime of that state. So that's a practical way where this is important. But it's not really the fun one. But there are ways in which this manifests itself. But where it really comes into play is in an area of physics which I call quantum field theory. That turns out to be the theoretical framework that describes particle physics and our understanding of all of the other forces of nature outside of gravity. And there will eventually, hopefully, be some sort of quantum field theory of gravity, but nobody's been smart enough to quite figure out how it works. So, let me sort of take this to an absurd limit for just a moment, all right? can effectively break conservation of energy if I do it over a short enough period of time. That's sort of what this uncertainty principle calls for. It's not a true breaking of conservation of energy in the sense that it is consistent with this thing. What it really says is that if I do it over a short enough period of time, the energy uncertainty is so much that if you could see it, it would seem as if it were breaking conservation of energy. So, did you see the Volvo? I just made a Volvo just appear. But it disappeared. It was there for such a short amount of time, you didn't perceive. Which, I hope, sounds ridiculous. But that's sort of what this allows you to do. If you look at nothing, a vacuum, okay? If I look at that over a short enough period of time, little spot of nothing, okay? My knowledge of the energy in that spot of nothing is so poor that I can have a huge amount of energy there. I can have enough energy that energy could manifest itself into a particle, could decay basically into a particle and antiparticle. That then come back together in a very, very short amount of time such that I don't violate this conservation of the assessment of uncertainty. So, within the uncertainty principle, nothing is no longer nothing. Nothing is viewed as a fabulous seeming sea of fluctuations in energy that happen very quickly and go away. And they can even be so large as to turn into particles and antiparticles, say like electrons and positrons. And you might say, well, that sounds completely ridiculous. And it sort of does. But when I said one of the refinements of quantum mechanics for the hydrogen atom, one of the things that they refine it with is they basically say, okay, I've got the nucleus and I have an electron. In addition, I have these little quantum fluctuations of electrons and positrons that happen in the space, in the vacuum. And those get slightly polarized by this electric field. And it weakens the electric field very slightly that the electron sees. And we can measure that. It has been measured. It's called the Lamb shift and the spectral line. So, as crazy as that idea sort of sounds, we actually measure this whole idea of vacuum polarization. So, it appears that this strange quantum mechanical freedom that we have turns out to be incredibly liberating because it basically allows all sorts of possibilities happen under the hood. Not in such a way that you can see it if you're just standing there looking at it, but you have to think about what quantum mechanics is giving you. Quantum mechanics is giving you the probability distribution. So if I look at a system for just a moment and I ask, what are the possibilities that I have to add into that probability distribution? I have to add in all of these funky possibilities that are allowed by the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And it turns out to be really, really important. And that's sort of what quantum field theory is. So let me give you a conceptual idea of forces as painted by this picture of quantum mechanics. We are used to thinking about, for example, an electron zipping through the vacuum as just the particle, okay? But because of the uncertainty principle, I could imagine that this electron is not just an electron, but it's an electron that emits a photon, and that photon comes back to the electron. And that happens over such a short time that it's consistent with Heisenberg uncertainty principle. But during that moment where you have the photon, if you could really add up all the energies, it would seem as if you were breaking conservation of energy. It happens over a very short time. You don't really. It's consistent with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, but it is a possibility.
You could have, instead of that, you could have the electron going along. The photon could be emitted. That photon could have enough energy that it pair produces into an electron and a positron. They come back together, creating a photon, which comes back to the original electron. I could have the electron going along. I could have a photon come out. I could have another photon come out. I could have this one pair produce. I could have this go. It could pair produce. And I can go on and on and on all day and have an infinite number of diagrams like this. Okay? And you think, well, why do I care? If I want to describe the electron in quantum mechanics, the electron is really the sum of all of these possibilities. And they're not all equally possible. For example, this process, because you have so many different things happening, you'd have to have such a much larger effective breaking of conservation of energy. So this is a much smaller probability than that, for example. So it is actually possible to calculate these things. Because these extra particles that are kicked out consistent with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle are not, they don't live forever because they can't. Because then they would break on Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. They have to only exist over a very short period of time. You can't really think of them as real. So we call them virtual particles because they are sort of instantaneous potential possibilities that have to get summed in when you want to talk about what the electron is. So I think it's easy enough to say, well, why do I care? Because you just said, I can do anything I want so long as I do it over such a short amount of time that nobody's the wiser. So why should we care? Okay. So it turns out that there are strange things that can happen. So for example, these virtual particles can carry electric charge. You have to conserve charge here. So this net sum, for example, I have the negative charge of this electron, and when I do this pair production, I have a positive and a negative, so I conserve charge. These particles do carry part of the momentum of the electron. So they carry part of the electron-ness, if you want. While they exist. So let us imagine that we have an electron moving along, and now, really, instead of thinking of the electron as a BB, you really have to think of it as sort of a cloud of virtual possibilities.
It's a cloud of virtual particles that sort of exist mathematically over a very fleetingly short amount of time. Okay, so that's sort of how you have to think of it. And you can imagine having
another electron going by. It also is sort of a cloud of virtual possibilities, okay, virtual particles.
Now, even though each of these virtual particles exists for only a very fleetingly short amount of time, what if they sort of got confused?
Suppose one of the virtual particles gets exchanged between those two electrons.
If the virtual particle carries momentum, then what you have is an exchange of momentum between these two electrons. A force is a change in momentum with respect to time. So you can construct a conceptual mathematical picture that is completely consistent with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, where you have an exchange of virtual particles that carry momentum. And that's what we call a force. So this basic idea of having virtual photons that can be exchanged turns out to be the quantum mechanical model, conceptually, of the electromagnetic force. And you probably have heard of Richard Feynman, his famous guy. He and a few others developed a whole framework for this in about the 1940s. It's called quantum electrodynamics. And it is an example of the quantum field theory. So we're going to talk a lot more about field theories and how to interpret it in terms of this virtual exchanges of particles as we go. It's not completely crazy. This whole idea of an exchange being the thing that conveys a force does happen classically. Let's suppose that I have, you know, a heavy ball. And I guess this isn't hard to imagine. Imagine I'm standing on ice, okay? And you're standing on ice near me. If I throw the ball at you, okay, when I push the ball, due to action and reaction, I have a recoil, so I'm moving on the ice. You're standing on the ice. When you catch that ball, you go sliding back. Okay? So that would be, for example, a force that is conveyed by the exchange of a particle. So we're basically doing that on a very short time scale here, mathematically. And because you're sort of in this mathematical never-never land of really short times and things that really you're not quite observing, it turns out these exchanges can both be repulsive or attractive depending on the nature of the particles you exchange. So in quantum field theory, different forces are caused by the exchange of different types of particles. And it turns out you can actually understand the nature of how the forces vary in terms of their characteristics by the nature of the particles that get exchanged. So we'll talk more about that when I get into particle physics. So let me stop there for a moment. Does anybody have any questions or comments, or do you want to laugh at it? Yeah.
So essentially, we just interrupt it to determine this thing. So that. That just means, essentially, that you won't be able to model this in a way that does not involve probabilities. Therefore, like any belief in determinism is not, is, I guess, comparable to a belief in multiple versions, because you can't really, like, refute it necessarily. Like, super determinism, like it was going to do that and have that spin, and that other one was going to hit it, and the electron was going to do that anyway because of some unknowable wave theory that violates every other sort of like basis.
I believe that believing in determinism right now would be purely fake. And I'm not even sure that I'm going to get too many double, I'm going to have triple negatives here, confuse myself and everybody else. It could be that if you sat and really thought about it, the success of things like quantum field theory might begin to make it hard to argue that there really can be a. I don't really know about that. That may be overstating it. Certainly, people can want to believe that such a thing exists, and that to me is almost religious. It's sort of religious at this point if you want to believe it, because we have this incredibly successful framework where the probabilistic interpretation just works perfectly. So, perhaps somebody smart will come along someday and give us a framework that is deterministic, that manifests itself in all of our observations in a way that is consistent with probabilistic interpretation. So perhaps it's really hard to imagine that. I mean, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle,
I mean, it really is just a wave thing. And it's pretty established. So it turns out that mathematically I can describe a wave in terms of a sum of components, each of which has different momenta. And spatially, as this wave gets narrower, the components that come into the momentum get much broader.
And that's really mathematically pretty rigorous. It's well understood. It's called Fourier analysis and Fourier transform. And vice versa. If I narrow down the momentum, then the spatial components that you use to describe it become very wide. So the moment you say that the particle is a wave, I really don't know how you avoid it. And so it does throw out the deterministic universe, which we can cry over, but it is also profoundly different, and it makes a lot of modern physics, including cosmological theories that seem to be working really well, and as of this morning seem to be working even better than anyone that ever had. We'll come back to that. Sorry, I'm still sort of excited about this whole bit that happened. But I don't know if you read any email or bothered reading the article, or the article made any sense yet, but if you recall, right at the start of the early part of the term, I gave you a talk very quickly about something called inflation, which is a superluminal expansion to the early stages of the universe that fixes a lot of problems with the Big Bang. So we'll talk a lot about that at length. Up until now, the idea of inflation has been supported largely because it fixes so many other things. And there was a paper that was just released today that gives pretty firm evidence that's supporting inflation and direct observational evidence. So there may be other ways that there are further measurements that have to be done to really confirm this, but based on everything that we currently know, it seems as if inflation is maybe observationally there. And as you'll see as we get further into the class, if inflation happened, I don't know how to avoid a multiple universe cosmological. I mean, I don't think it can be conceptually avoided. So it's actually rather exciting stuff. But that has nothing to do with what you asked. I don't know. Anything else? Okay. So we're going to come back to this because this liberating uncertainty, as strange as it seems, very Harry Potter sort of idea, turns out to be the very basis that underlies our particle physics theories that seem to work really, really, really well, and also underlies a lot of the cosmological stuff that we'll find happening in evolution theories.
Why do you say the global theories?
Why do I say what? It sounds sort of crazy. It also sounds a bit ridiculous. Basically, I tell you, I can break conservation of energy so long as I do it over short enough time that you can't see it. I had a friend back when I was about 5, and I remember he claimed that he had a flying machine, and I didn't believe it. And he swore up and down it was true. So I said, fine, show me. So we go to his house, and he has some planks nailed together in some strange configuration. And I said, okay, fine, make it fly. So we sat there, and I waited for it to fly. It didn't fly. I kept sort of giving him a hard time. And he's like, well, it does. It's just not doing it while we're here. So this feels a little bit like that, but it turns out to have, because of this probabilistic interpretation of quantum mechanics, I mean, these possibilities that could be there, even though you can't observe them, actually get factored into the calculations and makes all the difference. And conceptually, you can have exchanges of particles that happen sort of very quickly that can carry momentum, and that is the whole concept that underlies particles. So But it just seems sort of weird, right? Why do you care? I can make a ball go up here. Sure, it's there. You just didn't see it.
It actually kind of makes sense to me, because when you said you could see a bubble, or you made a bubble appear, the sound waves that you're seeing bounce, the particles interacting with my synapses, I know the bubble waves. So for a second I saw a bubble where you said you would make it appear. You know what's the difference? So,
oh yeah. Oh yeah. I didn't tell you about my superpowers.
How cool. Did anybody else experience that? Woo-hoo. All right. You made my day. Okay. So,
what I'd like to do now is to turn away from quantum mechanics per se and actually sort of start to probe down into inner space, and we'll end up talking about particle physics. And we have to talk a lot about particle physics, because if you want to understand the evolution of the universe, it turns out to be all made of particles and mass and everything, and we start out with something that's very hot and dense. In order to understand how things evolve, you have to understand how all the particles interact and
how quantum mechanics works in such a scenario. So it does all get tied together, but it may seem slightly a bit of an absurd break right now. So I want to head into inner space, and what I'd like to do now is we basically talked about the structure of an atom, and what I would like to do now is to talk about the structure of the nucleus itself. And both these guys were largely before your time. This guy less so, I suppose. These two presidents both said nuclear instead of nuclear. And I don't know about you, but it scares the crap out of me to have somebody who's got their finger on the nuclear button who can't even pronounce the word. I find that fundamentally very bothersome. So, at any rate, please, 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 I know that lots of people, for whatever reason, grow up saying nuclear. If you do, please learn to correct it. I have a graduate student who's currently working in neutrino physics. Basically, it's a form of nuclear physics. And he says nuclear, and it's driving me crazy. It is one of these things, it's like an accent or whatever. It's really hard to grab yourself out of it. So, anyway, please, the word is nuclear.
Okay, so nuclear physics is actually pretty simple at some level. We've already talked about the fact that if you take alpha particles, or little charged particles, and you shoot them through a gold foil, that these positive particles sometimes get scattered at very large angles.
And what that really means is that the positive charge in an atom is not diffuse. It is all concentrated in a very small region. That's what's called a nuclear atom. So what that means is that if within the atoms in the gold, most of the positive charge is concentrated in a central piece here and there, then it's like throwing darts. When you throw a dart of some other little positive particle, you very seldom hit the target. The probability of hitting the target, in fact, as the target goes to zero, becomes very small. But sometimes you get a little ways from it. So that positive nucleus will deflect the positive particle a bit most of the time. But once in a while, you head right for the nucleus, and now it's a big positive charge, it just kicks you straight back at a very large angle. And so we've talked a bit about how this was studied in Rutherford's lab in Newman, and he was able to infer from his work that most of the mass in the atom was concentrated in a region that was about 10 to the minus 15 meters in size.
He called it the nucleus. And the electron is more on the order of, you know, 10 to the minus 10 meters in terms of its the atom size, if you want to think of it that way.
So that's a huge difference. And what it means is that since the electron, we were talking about as a wave, if you want to think of it as a particle, you know it has a substructure. So you can sort of think of the atom as being almost all state. So there's a profound problem with this conceptual picture. Anybody got a thought of what that might be? You suppose I have an atom of one of these elements where I know I have a bunch of positive charge, a bunch of protons. In this strange picture, I'm taking all of these protons and I'm shoving them into a little sphere about the size of 10 to the minus 15 meters. And you can calculate, I mean, we've seen that Coulomb repulsion, the Coulomb force
between two positive particles, for example, that force goes as a constant times the charge for one times the charge for the other divided by the radius between them squared.
So as that radius becomes really, really small, this repulsive force between those positive charges becomes huge. So Rutherford's work shows that all of the positive charge in the nucleus appears to be concentrated in this small little region. If you calculate the Coulomb repulsion between all those positive particles, you get something astronomically large. So it just doesn't work unless you hypothesize the existence of another force. And this force happens to be attractive for protons to protons or protons to neutrons and stuff. So at that level of thinking, we know that there is a new force. We call it the strong nuclear force because we are so creative. So, if you want to think about it, we have a force that's highly repulsive between positive particles, but if you can get these protons and neutrons of things, the electrons don't appear to feel, okay? But protons and neutrons appear to. And it turns out you can take protons and shoot them at nuclei, and most of the time when they're deflected, it's as if they only feel the Coulomb repulsion of the nucleus. But if you shoot them with enough energy that they will approach to within about 10 to the minus 15 meters of the nucleus, all of a sudden that scattering changes. So the picture is consistent with the nucleus, with these particles, with there being a force that has a range of only about 10 to the minus 15 meters, which is highly attractive and much stronger than the Coulomb force, so that basically it pulls the nucleons together and holds them in the nucleus. That's sort of the picture.
So you can sort of imagine is a picture that I like to draw. Suppose this is the radius of a particle from the center of a nucleus. There is a positive repulsive force that goes as 1 over r squared that we can sort of picture like this. And a way to think about it is if a particle is at some radius out here, there's a repulsive force against it. And then at some distance, about 10 to the minus 15 meters, there's a highly attractive force that sort of pulls it in.
It turns out that there is, when you look at how solutions to Schrodinger's equation work, one of the general things you discover is that if you have an attractive force between particles that combine them together, like what you have in the atom, where we have a nucleus and an electron is bound to it, that when you have such a situation and you solve Schrodinger's equations, you will always get discrete energy levels. So that's where the quantization of the atomic levels comes from. This is actually no different. What we have is a new force that is highly attractive, that binds the protons and neutrons in a region called the nucleus. If you were to solve Schrodinger's equation with such a thing, you will find that you necessarily have to have energy levels. And protons and neutrons are different types of particles. They're fermions, so you, in each energy level, just like we have with the atom, we can have one proton spin up, one proton spin down, the next energy level spin up, spin down. We can do the same thing for the neutrons and nucleus. So it ends up that you get, because we have an what we would call an attractive potential, a way to think about that is it's just really a binding force. That if you have this, it implies discrete energy levels. And so if we want to imagine what a nucleus has, then we have something that is very similar to what we have with an atom, in that if we ask what are the potential energies that a proton or a neutron can have within this strange bound nucleus, we get discrete energy levels. So you can imagine some sort of low level energy and a higher energy and one that's even higher. And you can sort of fill these up. For the protons, you can have a spin up, spin down, spin up, spin down. And depending on how many protons you have in the atom, you sort of fill the shells just the way we did with multi-electron atoms. And you can do the same sort of thing with the neutrons. And if you recall, for atoms, spectral lines come from when you have the electron in some higher energy level and it drops down to a lower energy level, it emits a photon with exactly that difference in energy with that frequency. And that's the color you see for that spectral line. Chemistry happens because you have these atoms and it's energetically favorable for them to join together and give chemical bonds, for example.
where you rearrange the electrons between these discrete levels so that you have a slightly more stable system. In chemistry, when you do that, the difference in energy for these energy levels happens to be tens of so-called electron volts or so. If I have a huge number of these atoms, and I can induce them to all go through this change in a very short period of time, I can generate tens of electron volts per atom combination. And if I have, you know, the right stuff, like TNT, I can form an explosion. Okay? So if you release it all at once and you have a pretty unstable system and you go to a much more stable system, you can do that.
Here, so the difference in energy levels for atoms when you calculate them with Schrodinger's equation is like tens of electron volts. That's sort of where you get these kinds of energies from. When you calculate it for this strong a force that binds the nucleons so closely together in a nucleus, what you find is that these energy levels differ by a million electron volts.
So now if I have a pile of nuclei and I can induce them to go from a higher energy state to a lower energy state, when I do that per nucleon, I'm not generating tens of electron volts. I'm generating millions of electron volts per minute. And so fundamentally, this is why a stick of dynamite goes boom, and a nuclear bomb goes kapow. That's really the difference. It has to do with just the difference in the energy levels. And, you know, there's a big difference in the technology it takes to sort of set it off. But fundamentally, the changes per thing that happens in nuclear physics is at a scale that's a million times larger than what you have in normal chemical reaction.
You guys okay with that? Okay. Because these numbers are now so big,
it turns out that you can do a lot more than you can do when you just change an electron from one energy level to another in an atom. There, I have energy changes that are not so great. And the only thing I can produce, the only thing I can do with that energy, because the numbers are so small, is to generate a photon of light, which is massless. If I have these changes in energy, if they're large enough, then I actually have enough energy to create particles, to have particles in them. Because particles with mass have a threshold. You have to have a certain amount of energy to ever generate them, because E equals mc squared, I have to have, if something has mass, I have to have at least that much energy to create.
So, because these numbers are so big, it turns out that lots of other things can sort of happen with in nuclear physics. So I think you'll be playing with this some a week from Wednesday in recitation, not this week, but let me give you a quick tour of some nuclear physics. For each type of nucleus, it has different numbers of protons and/or neutrons. So we usually give it a symbol, and I'm going to have a generic symbol here, which I'll just call X. And then we have an A and a Z. This is the number of protons, which is the number of positive charges in the nucleus. A is the number of protons and neutrons. And it turns out that the protons and neutrons have very similar masses. They're not exactly, but effectively, A is a measure of the mass difference. This thing is the elemental symbol. And it's 1-to-1 with Z. It depends only on the number of protons in the nucleus. And you might say, well, why should that be? Remember that for neutral atoms, the number of positive charges and the number of negative charges for the electrons have to be equal to the neutral. So the more positive charges I have, the more electrons I have, and that means I fill the shell levels differently. And that's what determines chemistry. So when you want to talk about the chemical characteristics of something, for the atoms, it turns out to hinge on the Z, or which is 1-to-1 for this elemental symbol. So if Z is equal to 1, the elemental symbol we use is H. If Z is equal to 2, the elemental symbol we use is HE. If Z is equal to 3, it's Li for lithium, etc. The symbol for gold is AU. The symbol for tin is SN. So H1 would be the normal hydrogen atom, just a proton. You could have H12, which is hydrogen where I've added a neutron into the nucleus. Where you have the same number of protons, that is same Z, and basically same chemical characteristics, but differing numbers of neutrons. I can add neutrons and I don't add positive charge. I don't need an extra electron when I do that. So it turns out that I can add neutrons to a nucleus or take them away, and I don't actually change the chemical characteristics very much. But they do happen in different nuclei, and it turns out to be very important. This thing where you have the same number of protons and different number of neutrons, these are called isotopes. The nuclear characteristics might be very different if I add neutrons in. So they really are very different beasts, but chemically they react the same. So just like with atoms, I can have excited states in atoms where the electrons are sort of in these more energetic shell levels and they can fall back down naturally and emit light. You can have the same sort of thing with nuclei. Some nuclei you can think of as being basically in excited states of energy, and they will naturally decay into lower energy states. And when they do, they will usually do this by emitting energy in the form of other particles and stuff. And that's what we call natural radioactivity. Okay? And so the form, because you have a lot of energy, you have a lot of different things that can happen. You can have happen exactly what happens with atoms. That is, I could have a nucleus where one of the nucleons is in sort of a higher energy state. So I'm going to put a little star here by the symbol of the nucleus just to show that it's an excited state. It can have a certain number of protons and a certain number of protons plus neutrons. and it can decay by one of those nucleons, which is a generic word for a proton or a neutron, goes from its high energy state to a lower energy state, and when it does, it emits a quantum of light, a photon. So I'm going from a high energy state to a low energy state for the nucleus, and I emit a photon. And that photon will come off with a very particular energy, a very particular frequency. If you could see photons of this energy, you would see it as a spectrum, just like we have with atoms. The difference is these photons have hundreds of thousands to millions of electron volts, which means the photons are extraordinarily energetic, and we call them gamma rays. But a gamma ray is no different from the kind of light that you observe coming off the atoms, except that its frequency is vastly higher, and the photon itself has vastly more energy. Because we have a lot of energy, other things can happen. So we could have a nucleus of a certain type. I'll call it X prime. So it has a Z protons and A plus Z neutrons. This can decay into a nucleus of the same number of protons plus neutrons, but you literally change a neutron into a proton and emit an electron. So you conserve charge. The nucleus has taken a neutral particle, a neutron, and changed it to a proton, which increases Z and creates a new nucleus, a new type of nucleus, a new element, and it emits an electron in the process. We don't call this electron radiation. We call it beta radiation because when it was discovered, people had no idea what it was. So it's called them beta rays. So this would be what we call a beta ray. Or we could have beta radiation. You can have a very similar process where you have the proton decay into a neutron. And you emit a positively charged electron, which is actually an antiparticle for the electron. And it is called the positron. And those will also come off naturally sometimes. It is also known as beta ray. Okay, so you can sort of have negative betas and positive betas. You can have a nucleus with A neutrons plus protons and Z protons decay into something which is a different type of nucleus that has two less protons and two less neutrons, and it emits a particle which is called the alpha particle, and the alpha particle has two protons and two neutrons, which is basically the same thing as a helium nucleus. And this would be known as alpha decay or alpha radiation. So these things all have very different characteristics. You've seen one example already of carbon-14 dating. I think we did some stuff in recitation where carbon-14 nuclei
which are typical carbon nucleotides, they have 6 protons, but they have 2 additional neutrons. So instead of carbon-12, they have carbon-14. Carbon-12 is absolutely stable. I have a kilogram of carbon-12 sitting here that will just be here forever. If I have a kilogram of carbon-14 sitting here, as you've already learned, in 5,870-some years, I'll have exactly half of it left, because half of it will have decayed, and the mode of decay is this beta decay. It turns out that the energy of these betas and of the alphas, basically the difference in the energy levels that are decaying, are fixed. So they come off with a certain amount of energy, just like you have those spectral lines or atoms.
I think I'm going to ask you to discuss this in recitation in a week and a half, but just a quick bit of thinking about this.
Why is radiation something sort of dangerous? The fundamental aspect of it is you now have very energetic things, and some of them have charge. If you now ask how do they interact with things like the material in your body, they can ionize. They have enough energy to ionize. My body doesn't care about this life. It doesn't care about cell phone radiation in spite of the crap that you read sometimes. And the reason it doesn't is because those photons individually do not have enough energy to kick any electrons out of my atom. So it will not rip apart my body, my particles in my body. It won't rip apart molecules, so it won't cause cancer. It won't damage an organ. Here you've got a tremendous amount of energy. If I take a beam of alpha particles and try to pass it through material, how it interacts with the material is it rips electrons off of the atoms as it goes. We call it ionization. So it's a heavily ionizing particle. Because it's very massive and has a lot of charge, these alpha particles, they lose their energy very, very fast. The good part about that is that means they don't penetrate very deeply into the substance. So if I have an alpha source sitting outside my body, it's going to damage my skin if I'm sitting here too long. But the alphas will not penetrate into my inner body, so my pancreas and my liver won't get destroyed, and I won't have to worry about mutations for my kids. If I have alpha source inside my body, and it spreads throughout my body, it's very dangerous, because it's heavily ionizing, heavily damaging to the tissue when it happens. Beta decays, the electrons are light and they're less charged, so the same thing happens, but they're a little more penetrating and a little less damaging to the stuff. If you have a beta source outside your body, you'll feel sunburned if you're around it too much. So it does that kind of damage a little bit, but it's not going to penetrate deep into your body just typically. Gamma rays are very different. They're photons of light, and it turns out, like an X-ray, they can basically penetrate through material deeply and then potentially interact. Sometimes they'll go right through. So a gamma source outside my body is exceedingly dangerous because those photons now can penetrate into my body. Many of them will pass right through and they won't hurt me, but some of them will actually interact deep inside my body and hurt my organs. If I drink a gamma source, that's not so great, except I sort of blow gamma rays, so a lot of them will be in my body and bother. So you sort of have to, what's dangerous about radiation depends on a lot of things. It depends on the nucleus and how many particles get emitted per second, and that's different for different types of nucleotides. It depends on which type of radiation you're talking about. It depends on its location, inside your body, outside your body. It depends on how long you're hanging out beside it. It depends on how it's incorporated in your body, whether it passes right through or whether it becomes part of your being. You can even use this medically. You can take radioactive iodine that happens to collect in the thyroid, and if you have a cancer thyroid, it destroys that tissue preferentially. So it's a fabulous thing. So used right, radioactivity is a really, really, really handy thing. And we'll talk a bit more about these things, but it is also something you have to be pretty cautious with. But I think I'm out of time. Any thoughts, questions on this? Okay. I'll see you Wednesday.